Good morning. So many times I've been asked the question, which side of the Civil War were the Jews on? So most people assume the North. So it's funny that Annie Winter actually gave me an article to read from a newspaper in Atlanta, which was all about how Atlanta Jews were shocked to find out that there were actually Jews in the South and in Atlanta that supported the Confederacy. But that is the reality. We've all heard the old saying, two Jews, three opinions. The Civil War and slavery were no exception. Jews were divided as much as the country were. And these different views over the war, and interestingly enough, how Pesach was observed during the war, can tell us a lot about Jewish life in the 1800s and about our Jewish community across North America today. So let's start with a little background on the Civil War. I mean, there are books devoted to the reasons for the war, but very briefly, one of the major issues was states' rights. The states that would become the Confederacy wanted stronger states' rights and the ability to nullify federal laws that they didn't like. One of the issues that they very much wanted to be able to determine was slavery, both in their states in the South and in the new states that were coming into being with westward expansion. There was a moral component to slavery, meaning a debate on the morality of slavery, but there was also a practical economic element. The South was fighting to maintain the economic structure of their society. They wanted control of political power. A new political party was growing in popularity at the time. It was called the Republican Party. Maybe some of you have heard of it. The Republican Party was against westward expansion of slavery. And the election of a Republican president without a single electoral college vote from the southern states led the South to believe that in this current reality, they have no power. And that very much set them on a course for war. That Republican president was, of course, Abraham Lincoln, elected in November of 1860. The Confederacy seceded in February of 1861, and the war began in April of 1861. So what was the Jewish view on all this? So the Jewish community did not speak with one voice on slavery or on any other controversial issue. They didn't back then, and they don't today. One might think that because the Jews were slaves in Egypt, so that might make the Jewish people against slavery. But that wasn't the reality. And there was no actual religious prohibition in slavery. So in practice, what ended up happening was that Jews tended to follow where they lived. At the time of the war, 150,000 Jews lived in the North. About 25,000 lived in the South. Northern Jews generally supported the Union. The vast majority of the Jewish community in America at that time fell into this category. So an example of support for the Union, opposition to slavery, is Rabbi David Einhorn, who argued that, quote, rebellion against God to enslave human beings that were created in his image. He argued that slavery just does not go with Jewish values. And he noted that the Jewish experience, the fact that the Jews were slaves in Egypt, is a reason that the Jewish people should be more sensitive to the plight of slaves. He argued that even if literally the Torah says that slavery is permitted, that you need to focus on the context there and not the letter of the law, the spirit of the law. And that wasn't what was happening in the South. Other rabbis wrote against slavery, pointing out that the Bible requires a humane treatment of slaves, and that also wasn't happening in the South. There was brutality against slaves. They argued that that was then, this is now. You know, okay, in biblical times you could have a kind of slavery, but not in America today. Rabbi Einhorn was a rabbi in Baltimore, which was part of the South. And after this sermon against slavery, a riot broke out. They wanted to just tar and feather him, and he was chased out of Baltimore. He ended up going to Philadelphia. However, even those rabbis and those Jewish leaders and individual Jews who were opposed to slavery, they were still very hesitant to affiliate with the abolitionist movement because many of the abolitionists, they were strong evangelical Protestants. And they had been missionaries, they were involved in attempts to convert Jews, and a lot of them used anti-Jewish imagery and anti-Semitic tropes, anti-Semitic language. One abolitionist called a Jewish leader the descendant of the monsters who nailed Jesus to a cross between two thieves. So even if you had Jews who believed ideologically with the abolitionists, they still weren't going to officially affiliate with the abolitionist movement because that movement was so unpopular in the Jewish community. And that's not only true about abolitionists. There's a whole complicated history of Jewish involvement in the suffrage movement and other social movements because there were always very Christian elements, and sometimes they didn't want to affiliate with the movement, and sometimes the movement didn't want to be affiliated with Jews. Now, for Jews in the South, they generally supported the Confederacy. They supported slavery. What's their attitude? The Bible allows slavery. There's no explicit prohibition. We do what our neighbors do. So taking, for example, the town of Charleston, Jews who could afford slaves, which was most, owned slaves. Generally in Charleston, anyone who could afford slaves owned slaves, and that included the free blacks who lived in Charleston. They also owned slaves. So now we have opinion one, which is pro-slavery and pro the Confederacy and Civil War. Two, which is very anti-slavery. And then there's opinion three, because we said two Jews, three opinions. Our third opinion is avoid war at all costs. The most important thing, avoid war. If we have to compromise over slavery, so we'll compromise over slavery. And one example of that approach was Rabbi Morris Raphael of New York City, who said that even if Southern slaveholders had acted badly, so slaveholding wasn't a sin, it is protected in the Torah, so therefore it's just not worth going to war over. And this sermon becomes very popular among Christians, and he was considered the view of a very learned rabbi. But as historians like Jonathan Sarna point out, it also shows the differences between Christianity and Judaism. Because in Christianity, denominations had a party line. You know, there was a belief of a denomination. But the Jewish community never spoke with a single voice, never spoke with one opinion. So like Jews were on both sides of the issue, they also served on both sides of the war, the Union and the Confederate armies. Between 8 and 10,000 Jews fought. Some rose in the ranks. Their religion did not seem to hinder their progress. There's even some early affirmative action. People promoted because they were Jewish. Abraham Lincoln said in 1862 he ordered the appointment of a Jew to captain because, quote, we have not yet appointed a Hebrew. On the home front, Jews contributed money to the war. They sewed clothing. They prepared bandages. They tended to the wounded. Jewish women in the South were involved in a Confederate spy ring. Jews in the North helped with the Underground Railroad. Has anyone been to the Touro Synagogue in Newport or seen pictures? What's the most famous feature of that shul? Yeah. Yes. There's a trap door and a tunnel under the bima, which they built because of fears from anti-Semitism. Well, that trap door and that tunnel was actually used to hide escaped slaves during this time period. Jews also on both sides were collecting tzedakah funds for the poor and for the needy. And they donated to both loyalties because, you know, who do we give our money to? Do we give our money to the Jewish poor in need because of this? Or do we give our money to the Confederate people in need, the Union? And ultimately, they give to both. They give to both. So the war pitted Jew against Jew, even family members against family members. If you look in the source sheets at the last page, you can see the image of two brothers who were actually fighting on different sides of the war. They're different. It's amazing to see how similar they look, but the totally different uniforms. Two brothers could be meeting each other on the battlefield. And that wasn't unusual, to have different members of a family living in different places, they're fighting on different sides. But some commonalities existed across Northern and Southern Jews, and one of those was a desire to maintain Jewish observance in the army. There is a letter of a man whose son was a soldier in the Union Army, and he wrote to Lincoln because President Lincoln had declared Sunday to be a day of rest in the army. And this father was writing to ask if his son, like other Jewish people, could be permitted to observe the Sabbath on Saturday and not be punished or forced to go to church on Sunday. And this father, although he was an immigrant, was savvy enough to frame his request as a religious liberty issue. And in his letter, he invokes the Constitution, he invokes the Declaration of Independence. You know, how could you withhold this right from my son? There was also a Jewish soldier in the Union Army who wrote letters that were published in a Jewish newspaper that detailed Jewish observance during the war. He writes, "Many people take it for granted that every soldier is an infidel, and that no sooner does he enter on active duty than he banishes all idea of religion from his mind. This is a great mistake, at least as far as the Jews are concerned. My own observation has convinced me that military life does not injuriously affect their ideas of duty and devotion, but that, on the contrary, in well-disciplined minds, it evokes religious feelings of the most sterling character. It is quite common for Jewish soldiers belonging to the same company to meet together for worship on Sabbath in some secluded spot. And I know a young soldier who was in Yom Kippur morning ordered to take part in a skirmish near Harper's Ferry, which he had to go through without having tasted food. And as soon as the enemy retreated, he retired to the woods where he remained until sunset, reading his prayers." So Jews were able to maintain observance and were given accommodations to observe. This could be for the high holidays, for Shabbat, or for Pesach, for Passover. And we can see that clearly in two accounts of Pesach Seders, one written by a Confederate soldier and the other by a Union soldier. So if you look at the first page, we're going to read from this Confederate Passover. This is a letter written by a soldier to his sister back on the home front. "Dear Leonora, no doubt you are much surprised on receiving a letter from me addressed to our dear parents, dated on the 21st, which was the first day of Pesach. We were all under the impression in camp that the first day of the festival was the 22nd. And if my memory serves me right, I think that Ma wrote that Pesach was on the 22nd. Zeke, that's his brother also in the army, was somewhat astonished on arriving in Charleston on Wednesday afternoon to learn that it was the first Seder night. He purchased matzo sufficient to last us for the week. The cost is somewhat less in Richmond, being but $2 a pound." So here, it's cheaper in Richmond, cheaper, because it's $2 a pound. Matzah in New York was 6 cents a pound, just to give you an idea of the price differentials. "We are observing the festival in a truly Orthodox style. On the first day, we had a fine vegetable soup. It was made of a bunch of vegetables with which Zeke brought from Charleston, containing new onions, parsley, carrots, turnips, and a young cauliflower. Also, a pound and a half of fresh kosher beef. The latter article sells for $4 per pound in Charleston." And he goes on just to give general news and ask about family members. So what's interesting about this account? So first of all, they weren't 100% sure what the first day of Pesach was. And I guess we can kind of understand that. It's not like they had a calendar on their phone or a calendar that they were sent, you know, around Rosh Hashanah time from some tzedakah. And, you know, they're stuck in the middle of war, in the middle of battle. And I think it's pretty, you can understand that they might have forgotten what the first day is. Although he does make a real point of emphasizing, even though we kind of messed up the first day of the holiday and sent letters when we should have, but we observed it like in a really Orthodox style. You know, you get the feeling that they really want to send that message home of like, no, we are observing it. I want to pay attention a little bit to the prices. So $2 in 1864 would be equivalent to $32.20. American, 40 Canadian, I don't know, 40 something Canadian, right? So that's quite expensive. Kosher beef, that price is equivalent to $64.20. So, I mean, that's a lot of money. Yeah.
Someone put the word kosher in square brackets?
Yes. It's implied from the letter, but they put it in more just to make the point that that's what it was referring to. Yeah. So we know that about their observance. They're busy fighting. We know that the prices are very expensive. Why do you think the prices, by the way, were so expensive on the kosher?
War.
What?
War.
It's wartime. Probably these products are being manufactured in the north. which means they're being smuggled into the South, which is going to make them much more expensive, or they're paying a huge tax on it. But you see that they're religious and they're committed, and they are doing their best to observe under those conditions. Okay, let's look at the Union Passover. I want to start actually about 10 lines down in the middle of the 10th line where it says, while lying there, he says, he goes on talking about his experience in the war and then where they were camped. So while lying there, our camp duties were not of an arduous character. And being apprised of the approaching Feast of Passover, 20 of my comrades and co-religionists belonging to the regiment, there's a good bunch of them, united in a request to our commanding officer for relief from duty in order that we might keep the holy days, which he readily acceded to. The first point was gained, and as the paymaster had lately visited the regiment, he had left us plenty of greenbacks. Our next business was to find some suitable person to proceed to Cincinnati, Ohio, to buy us matzot. Our sutler, being a co-religionist and going home to that city, readily undertook to send them. We were anxiously awaiting to receive our matzos, and about the middle of the morning of Erev Pesach, a supply train arrived in camp, and to our delight, 7 barrels of matzos. On opening them, we were surprised and pleased to find that our thoughtful sutler had enclosed 2 Haggadahs and prayer books. We were now able to keep the Seder nights if we could only obtain the other requisites for that occasion. We held a consultation and decided to send parties to forage in the country, while a party stayed to build a log hut for the services. About the middle of the afternoon, the foragers arrived. Having been quite successful, we obtained 2 kegs of cider, a lamb, several chickens, and some eggs. Horseradish or parsley we could not obtain, but in lieu we found a weed, whose bitterness, I apprehend, exceeded anything our forefathers enjoyed. We were still in a great quandary. We were like the men who drew the elephant in the lottery. We had the lamb, but we did not know what part was to represent it at the table. But Yankee ingenuity prevailed, and it was decided to cook the whole and put it on the table. Then we could dine off of it and be sure we had the right part. The necessaries for the charoses we could not obtain, so we got a brick, which, rather hard to digest, reminded us by looking at it for what purpose it was intended. All right, now we get to the event itself. At dark, we had all prepared and were ready to commence the service. There being no chazan present, I was selected to read the services, which I commenced by asking the blessing of the Almighty on the food before us and to preserve our lives from danger. The ceremonies were passing off very nicely until we arrived at the part where the bitter herb was to be taken. We all had large portion of the herb ready to eat at the moment I said the blessing. Eat each his portion, when horrors, what a scene ensued in our little congregation, it is impossible for my pen to describe. The herb was very bitter and very fiery, like cayenne pepper, and excited our thirst to such a degree that we forgot the law authorizing us to drink only 4 cups. And the consequences was we drank up all the cider. Those that drank the more freely became excited. One thought he was Moses, another Aaron, and one had the audacity to call himself Pharaoh. The consequence was a skirmish, with nobody hurt, only Moses, Aaron, and Pharaoh had to be carried to the camp, and there left in the arms of Morpheus, you know, the god of sleep. This slight incident did not take away our appetite, and after doing justice to our lamb, chickens, and eggs, we resumed the second portion of the service without anything occurring worthy of note. There, in the wild woods of West Virginia, away from home and friends, we consecrated and offered up to the ever-loving God of Israel our prayers and sacrifice. I doubt whether the spirits of our forefathers, had they been looking down on us, standing there with our arms by our sides ready for an attack, faithful to our God and our cause, would have imagined themselves amongst mortals enacting this commemoration of the scene that transpired in Egypt. So it's certainly a very colorful account. And think about a few things looking at this. What's their Jewish identity? So they want to have a Seder. They request from their commander some time off for it, which they're granted. They know how to read the Haggadah. They know the things they need. It's unclear how educated they were, unclear exactly how observant they were. There's a few like slight mistakes or misinterpretations. But okay, it seems to be a very nice Seder. What's really interesting, a couple points that are interesting. Faithful to our God and our cause. To them, it's the same. Our God, our cause. This cause has a religious character to it. And in a sense, fighting for the Union is an observance as well. And then their American identity. For them, it's hand in hand. God, the Union cause, hand in hand. And when they can't figure out exactly how to do something in the Seder, Yankee ingenuity prevailed, right? That whole ethos of the Yankee ingenuity, right? The writer of this letter sees himself as a total Northerner. He is a Northerner, and that feeling of being a Northerner is very clear in the letter. You see that in the way he expresses his identity. And you see how political opinions on the war were put into religious terms. And that happened globally. You see that in the Seder, and you see that in prayers that were composed on both sides. So if you look at the next source, it's a prayer for the Confederacy. So we'll start, the translation of Shema is done with the traditional Sephardic translation, and then we'll go to the second paragraph. This once happy country is inflamed by the fury of war. A menacing enemy is arrayed against the rights, liberties, and freedoms of this, our Confederacy. The ambition of this enemy has dissolved fraternal love, and the hand of fraternity has been broken asunder by the hands of those who sit now in council and mediate our chastisements with the chastisement of scorpions. Our firesides are threatened. The foe is before us with the declared intention to desecrate our soil, to murder our people, and to deprive us of this glorious inheritance which was left to us by the immortal fathers of this once great republic. Here I stand now with many thousands of the sons of the sunny South to face the foe, to drive him back, and to defend our natural rights. O Lord God of Israel, be with me in the hot season of the contending strife. Protect and bless me with health and courage to bear cheerfully the hardships of war. I mean, do you hear the language, how the traditional Jewish language is woven in to the politics? O Lord, ruler of nations, destroy the power of our enemies. Grant not the longings of the wicked. Suffer not his wicked device to succeed, lest they exalt themselves. Selah. Weaving literally in the words of Tehillim into the prayer. As for the heads of those that encompass me about, let the mischief of their own lips cover them. Let burning coals be cast upon them. Let them be thrown into the fire, into deep pits, that they rise not up again. Be unto the army of this Confederacy as though were of old, unto us thy chosen people. Inspire them with patriotism. Give them, when marching to meet or overtake the enemy, the wings of the eagle. In the camp, be thou their watch and ward. And in the battle, strike for them, O Almighty God of Israel, as thou didst strike for thy people on the plains of Canaan. Guide them, O Lord of battles, into the paths of victory. Guard them from the shaft and the missile of the enemy. Grant that they may ever advance to wage battle and battle in thy name to win. Grant that not a standard be ever lowered among them. O Lord God, Father, be thou with us. Give unto the officers of the army and the navy of the Confederate States enterprise, fortitude, and undaunted courage. Teach them the ways of war and the winning of victory. Guard and preserve, O Lord, the President of the Confederate States and all officers who have the welfare of the country truly at heart. Bless all my fellow citizens and guard them against sickness and famine. May they prosper and increase. So if you note how the writer of this prayer and others make the Confederate cause into the cause that God believes in. The Confederate people, they are the chosen people, just like the Jews are the chosen people. And there's similar prayers in the North. For example, in Mikveh Israel synagogue in Philadelphia, there was a prayer that God should lead his misguided children back to the Union, back and back to loyalty to the United States. In all cases, who's on our side? God is on our side. The battle is a religious battle. It's so core to their beliefs. It's so important to their identity. It becomes a religious battle. But what's interesting is that even with the virulent disagreements between Jews, Jewish loyalty is hard to overcome. Now, we know that the war pitted Jew against Jew, even family member against family member. But on the other hand, we see examples of Jewish interconnectivity across the borders. And a great example is if you look at source 4. This is a portrait of Rabbi Max Lilienthal. He was a very popular Reform rabbi in Cincinnati. He was Northern, and he was anti-slavery. So his picture had hung in the house of this man, this Jewish man who lived in New Orleans. And this man wrote this message defacing the picture of Lilienthal, wrote Lilienthal a letter, and mailed the picture back to him. And the letter, what he wrote across his face, "Sir, since you have discarded the Lord and taken up the sword in defense of a Negro government, your picture, which has occupied a place in our southern home, we herewith return that you may present them to your beloved black friends, as they will not be permitted in our dwellings. I shall be engaged actively in the field and should be happy to rid Israel of the disgrace of your life." Okay, it's a pretty strong statement. Okay, he's ready to, not only is he thrown out of the home, I mean, he's ready to kill him over the beliefs. That's how strongly he feels. Except a couple of lines later, "Should you ever desire to extend any acquaintance with me, here's my name and my address so we can correspond and be friends." You know, so even even the author is conflicted, because on the one hand, Lilienthal's a unionist and he hates him for that. But on the other hand, he's still a fellow Jew and he's this prominent rabbi. And even in his letter of hatred, he can't really fully cut the ties. Another thing is I just want to point out the letter that Max Lilienthal had signed it along with a pasuk, "The Lord is my banner," and he crossed it out and made "Abraham Lincoln is your banner." You know, that he has replaced God. He's accusing Lilienthal of having replaced God with Abraham Lincoln. Sure.
I'm just wondering, going back to the sort of controversy.
Yeah. Right, which is more what the prayer for the government reads today. Right.
So it's very striking and, again, odd that, like, there's this notion that God is American. Like, God is invested in this American project and wants to preserve America in whatever way the person speaking this prayer believes is,
right.
The right way. Where does that come from?
Because I believe that they felt this was a religious cause, a religious impetus. And I think that partially, that might come from the general structure in America, where it was a very Christian cause. You know, the morality over slavery. It was on both sides, not just for Jews. It was tied into religion. There was a religious impetus to it. But that's part of the point I'm trying to make, is that in America, that they conflated their Jewish observance and their American identity. It became one. And yeah, God is American and on our side. That's right. You're 100% right.
It's a little weird.
I mean, that's why, right. I mean, as I'm bringing the source, yeah. I mean, yes, that's what they did. Yeah. Okay, so I think that that's where there was a little bit of tension. That is the tension of the writer of the Lilienthal letter. There is that tension that we are on opposite sides, but there is still that interconnectivity. I played on some border jumping, which was, you know, people going from one side to the other, that yes, there was still a Jewish identity. Even though he hates him, he's still giving him his name and address. He's desperate for a connection with him. Even though this writer hates Max Lilienthal, he's desperate for a connection. And that's really what I want to talk about now, that there is this big conflict. So when Northern soldiers start occupying Southern areas, So they start attending the local synagogues, and that was very complicated. It was complicated for both sides because these people are the enemies, but these people are also our brethren. So we're supposed to hate them because they're northern soldiers, but they're showing up at Shul. And there were times where Union soldiers were guarding other Jews and in the South, and the Jews in the South recognized that this was a struggle for the Union soldiers, that this wasn't easy for them either, and that they felt bad. They could see that the Jewish soldiers from the North felt bad for the Jews in the South and for the treatment that they were required to kind of give them. Jonathan Sarna, historian, cites a letter in which some local Jews in Memphis got very frightened because a northern colonel in full military regalia wished them a happy Sabbath and asked where he might find a kosher lunch. Right, so it's 19th century bageling, right? The need to identify, like, I am also Jewish. Hi, I'm also Jewish. Let's have a connection, right? So even on different sides, there is this need to connect. Okay, there's also a sense of responsibility for Jews, regardless of where they were from. And if you look at that last source, this is from the Savannah Daily Herald in 1865. This morning, 13 cases of matzah Passover bread were received by the steamer U.S. Grant. The bread, a contribution of Israelites in the North to their brethren in Savannah, is consigned to A.J. Brady. The Reverend A. Epstein, reader of Congregation Mikveh Israel, is charged with its distribution. All who are able to pay for it will do so, and to those unable, it is a free will offering. So we have the North and the South being mortal enemies, but the North donated matzahs to the South because they might be our mortal enemies, but they're also Jews, and they need matzah for Pesach. So we're going to send it to them. There were also efforts by some to maintain connections despite differences. If you've heard of Rebecca Gratz, she was a famous woman in Philadelphia. She started Hebrew schools in America. And she made efforts specifically to write to family across the country to maintain connections, making a very conscious effort to leave politics out. And try, let's emphasize what connects us instead of emphasizing, bringing up what divides us. So we've looked at how Jews looked at each other. How did America feel about Jews? So the Christian heads of the army, they let them have their Seder, no problem. And Jews were not afraid to ask, which shows a level of confidence and comfort. War globally was a time when Jewish presence and Jewish confidence was tested. So let's look at the South. Judah Benjamin. You ever all heard of Judah Benjamin? So he was the first Jewish senator, not by birth, but the first Jewish senator who did not renounce his faith. He was from Louisiana. He supported secession, and he ended up serving as Attorney General, as Secretary of War, and as Secretary of State in the Confederacy. He was considered Jefferson Davis's right hand. He was hugely powerful. He was intermarried, and he was not observant at all, but he always acknowledged that he was a Jew, and he was identified by others as a Jew. So he rose very high in the ranks. In the North, there were some struggles to be Jewish and American. So one is the military chaplaincy law. This was passed in 1861, and it said that a chaplain in the army had to be a regular ordained minister of some Christian denomination. Now, there was an amendment to include a more inclusive phrase of some religious society, but it was voted down. The Confederate Army was actually more inclusive. They used the term minister of religion, and there were Jewish chaplains. In the North, Jewish chaplains were barred from the field, which did put Jewish soldiers at a great disadvantage and, in effect, made the Jewish faith illegitimate. At least two Jewish chaplains were actually rejected for being Jewish, and there was a national debate on the issue, and there were many in the North who did support changing this law, but there were also evangelicals who were against it. And really, it really was a debate about religious freedom because the law was against non-Christians, and there was an element here of, well, if we let Jews in, then who's next? God, we're going to have to let in the Mormons. We're going to have to let in Indian conjurers. I mean, where does it end? So one of the rejected Jewish chaplains, the Reverend Arnold Fisher, he went to Washington and he actually lobbied the president, and Lincoln did promise him support. And eventually a revised bill was passed to say some religious denomination. So this was a major political victory for the Jewish community, and it also remains a landmark legal recognition in America of non-Christians. The other piece of legislation that I want to mention is something called General Orders 11. So who's heard of General Orders 11? Oh, good. Nope, that's great. Okay, General Orders 11 is kind of one of these things that is so significant that it's amazing how little Jews today know about it, how little it's taught, how little we learn about it. The background to General Orders 11 is that there was widespread smuggling within the war in the border states, and oftentimes that was condoned by both governments. In December of 1862, Ulysses Grant issues General Orders 11 from his headquarters. And what it says is it blames the smuggling on the Jews. And it says that the Jews, as a class, violating every regulation of trade established by the Treasury Department and also department orders, you know, they're involved in smuggling, are hereby expelled from the department. Jews were expelled from Tennessee, Kentucky, and Mississippi, areas along the borders. They're expelled within 24 hours from the receipt of this order by post commanders. They will see to it that all of this class of people be furnished passes and required to leave. And anyone returning after such notification will be arrested and held in confinement until an opportunity occurs of sending them out as prisoners, unless furnished with permits from headquarters. This is known as the most sweeping anti-Jewish legislation in all of American history. It 100% blamed Jews as a class for the smuggling and the cotton speculation that was happening in this area, which was under Grant's command. So the Jews were expelled, and even though, really, I mean, were there some Jews involved in smuggling? Yes. But they weren't the majority. They certainly weren't involved any more than anyone else living in that area. Okay, so why blame the Jews? Jews were easily identifiable by their manners, okay, by their last names, and there are those age-old, you know, anti-Semitic stereotypes, and this came into play there. So Jews, anyone who was profiting from the war, so they came to symbol, you know, Jews came to symbolize anyone there who's profiting. So Jews were furious. They were really furious, and they immediately start protesting. So a Jew named Caesar Caskell, who was from Paducah, Kentucky, one of the areas where Jews were expelled, he goes to Lincoln and finds that Lincoln actually knew nothing of the order. He didn't know about it. He'd never seen it. And according to tradition, the following conversation took place. Abraham Lincoln says, "And so the children of Israel were driven from the happy land of Canaan?" And Caskell responds, "Yes. And that is why we have come unto Father Abraham's bosom, asking protection." And Lincoln then responds, "And this protection they will have at once." Now, whether or not that precise dialogue happened, historians are always skeptical of these things, Lincoln ordered the act be repealed immediately. And Lincoln assured Jewish leaders, quote, "To condemn a class is, to say the least, to wrong the good with the bad. I do not like to hear a class or nationality condemned on account of a few sinners." So the order is repealed, and within a few weeks, the whole issue blows over. But the implications, okay, what are the implications? So one, it does remind Jews that there is prejudice against them alive and well, even in America. On the other hand, think of how empowering this event was, because what did this show? They could fight back against bigotry, they could fight back against anti-Semitism, and they could win. They won. They won against General Grant. Okay, he wasn't a nobody. They won against General Grant. So in fact, this did strengthen the Jewish community. It strengthened its self-confidence. And along with the whole chaplaincy episode, it validated what we have until today, which is an activist Jewish community agenda. We have a Jewish community with leaders who are not afraid to be activists, who will involve public officials, and will base their agenda, will base the things they want to do on American laws, on American values, and especially this great American value of equality. Now, we also see it's the same increased confidence that we see in the Seders and that we see in their religious observance, that they have no problem, these soldiers have no problem asking for their observance, publicly observing, and they have no, in their minds, there is no contradiction with being proud observant Jews and with being Americans. Now, the war ends on Erev Pesach. Lee surrenders on April 9th in 1865. And throughout the North, that Pesach starts with celebration. Again, the victory is in a religious light. This is another redemption. Of course, we know that a few days later, Lincoln is shot. And he dies on the fifth day of Pesach. And the North is plunged into mourning. And the synagogues, instead of their usual holiday tunes, are now filled with tunes of mourning. And Lincoln is likened in sermons, guess to who? To Moses, yeah, to Moshe, who died without entering the promised land. And the same kind of concept that Lincoln died without ever really seeing the fruition. After the war, Jews again follow their neighbors. The North, they move on. And the South turns that mourning into the lost cause. And this lost South also becomes almost like a religious observance. So what do all these experiences of Jews in the Civil War, celebrating Pesach in the Civil War, what can they tell us? I want to bring up three big themes that resonate today. First, while Jews embraced their American identities, North and South, in the end, they maintained deep connections to fellow Jews. Today, Jews are on very different sides of the political spectrum, and politics are as divisive as ever. And yet still, we see a deep connection. Second, like Jews in the past, we also have comfort and we have confidence, but we also see latent anti-Semitism on the rise. The outside world looks at Jews, for better or for worse, as a Jewish collective. We are the Jewish people. The actions of one impact. But the truth is, to a great extent, we also look at ourselves as a Jewish collective and take pride when someone Jewish does something great and grimace when there's something negative press on the community. But whatever side they were on, they felt free, right? The Jews in that time period, they felt free. They embraced their sides partially because they felt free. They loved America because they felt free. And we continue in America and in Canada to enjoy that freedom. So taken together, right, we should continue as a community to enjoy that freedom while emphasizing our connection to other Jews. In spite of diverse political opinions and a very divisive political landscape, it's ever important for the Jewish community to focus on commonalities and to embrace the message of the Pesach Seder, Kol Dichvin Yete V'Yechol. Everyone is welcome at our table because we are one people, one nation, and we welcome each other and we embrace each other in our lives. Thank you.